coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, oh, hello, there we are. Haha. Hope everybody's doing great. Howdy, everybody. Welcome. Happy Tuesday night. Hope you've had a great week. The world is madness out there, so be close to those that you love, folks. That's all I can say. I am very, very excited about the show tonight. We have some great shows coming up as well. Ends up, we will be going out to Roswell for Roswell UFO Fest and garnering a few interviews there. So stay tuned for that coverage. We will also have a friend of the podcast, John Brandenburg, on very soon, as well as Hakim Isler, the founder of Cygames. He will be coming on next week to talk about Cygames and the founding of that, as and what that really means for the community of remote viewing as well as parapsychological research. It is an awesome event. I cannot wait for it. It's going to be great. I will be speaking there, so make sure that you stop on by and get your tickets at Cygames International, folks. Our guest in the second segment next week will be our friends from ArcheoX. We will be talking about them, about further explorations in Belize, things like that. Our guest in the second segment tonight is Dr. Megan Rose. We will be talking with her about the idea of normalizing paranormal. And this is a topic that I hold near and dear to my heart. The idea of letting people know that it's okay that they had a paranormal experience. It's something that we talk about on this show all the time. The idea that there is a lot of shame that is sometimes carried with a paranormal experience. And to make that public, to be able to have a comfortable space, to be able to know that people will not ridicule you whenever you come out and say, I've seen a UFO, I've seen a UAP, I've been abducted in my sleep. Like myself, I've had shadow people touch me, things like that. So how do you come forward with that to begin with? So we'll be talking about the idea of normalizing the paranormal in the second part of the show tonight. In the first show, we are very proud to bring on Martin Keller. He is the author of the new book, The Space Pin Club. He has a long career as an author. He is also a, well, former member of CSETI and used to work with them in their PR department, things like that. Welcome to the show, Martin Keller. How are you doing this evening?
Hey, Chris. I'm doing all right. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. I am happy to bring this book out. It is awesome to talk to somebody who has had a career like yourself in the world of UFO, UAP, especially in the world of PR, because not a lot of people realize the work that it takes for institutes like CSETI, for people like Dr. Stephen Greer, for people like the New Paradigm Institute, things like that, Stephen Bassett, to be able to get their work out there and be able to get it in front of the proper eyes that treat it with respect and properly. So thank you so much for your many years of work in that realm, Martin.
Well, thanks. It was kind of a long and winding road to get to that point. Earlier in my career, I was a music journalist here in the Twin Cities, and I covered pop culture from the late 70s to the early 90s. And, you know, the 80s here in Minnesota were pretty exciting. You had the rise of Prince.
Yep.
You had alternative kick-ass bands like The Replacements, Husker Du, Soul Asylum. In a parallel realm, you had all these great Minnesota comics like Louie Anderson, Joel Hodgson, who created the wonderful Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yeah.
There was a lot going on back in the 80s, and I was there to chronicle it, and I felt really lucky to do that. And you know what? I frankly got burned out doing it, and that's when I went into public relations, and I kind of came into the whole UFO thing in the early 90s. That said, I had been interested in it since I was a kid and had a sighting in high school with three other friends in Western North Dakota. Oh, in wow. One very cold night in February, long ago.
Well, with that in mind, how did you, because one of the things that we've talked about and that has actually been all over the news lately is, of course, the embedding of media with the government and the idea that much of what was apparently put out by media, things like that, were covers by the government for actual programs that were out there, things like that. That's what new documents are coming out and saying, things like that. So how do you, especially as somebody who worked in the field of journalism in pop culture at that time, because that would have been, I guess, as close to who would have probably covered such a thing at that point. Up until today, when now we have like scientists like Michio Kaku and things like that that talk about these things regularly on CNN, all kinds of stuff. But back in the 70s, early 80s, it was one of those, it was kind of tabloid material to talk about UFO, UAP.
It's been tabloid for a long time, partly by design, going back to the 40s and 50s when the Robertson panel in 52 convened and came up with what I think is pretty nefarious but effective plan to how to deal with UFO reports and people, moreover, people who were reporting them. And their MO for that was basically to ridicule the source and to deny that what they saw ever happened. And that, you know, as simple as that sounded, it was very effective. This new reporting around the topic that it was used as a cover for deep black projects in aerospace. I mean, it's not really new. That's been around for a long
exactly.
time. I actually get into that in my book, but it's new to people who are finally discovering like, oh, they're having hearings on this in Washington.
Yeah.
Maybe there is something to this. So it's never become more mainstream than it has in the last few years, especially beginning with that New York Times cover story in December of 2017. That really was a complete watershed moment, and things have not been the same since.
Well, and once again, huge watershed moment for the cause of disclosure, things like that. Now, even just the idea of bringing it forward, even that year, the MUFON conference, the topic of discussion was UFOs and the media. And we started seeing things, like I said on the show all the time, it was funny to hear the media start using the term UFO deniers and things like that, you know, where it's like, oh, wow, well, there's a slight switch in stance on how we're going to cover this. You know, before it may have been like the last 3 minutes of the news making fun of something or talking about Jim Bob who saw something in his backyard. But now we're talking about government whistleblowers, everything else. So the dialogue has totally changed. And it's really interesting to see, once again, the work of people like Stephen Greer popping to the forefront, people like, once again, New Paradigm, stuff like that, Steve Bassett, finally getting their due in this cause. So what was it like for you? How did you come to work with CSETI to begin with?
Well, I probably wouldn't be sitting here tonight and probably wouldn't have written the book that I wrote called The Space Pen Club if it wasn't for Stephen Greer. I actually met Greer through a fellow friend here in Minneapolis who told me about these Sky Watches she was going on with him, and the fact that Dr. Greer at that point wanted someone to write about him. And since I had some experiences in high school and I read as much as I could on topic about it back then from the very slim available resources like UFO magazine and the occasional bad TV special.
Yeah.
So I went and I met Greer. I spent a weekend in Los Angeles, went to one of his workshops, and then the night contact experience, the Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind initiative, where humans are initiating contact using, for him, he has these protocols using sound, light, and remote viewing, which I found fascinating because in my run-up to meeting Greer, I started having some very strange experiences happening inside my house and my head. I had a very lucid dream one night where I was in a harbor city and there was a collapsed pier and it was smoldering kind of just above the waterline, and all of a sudden a flying bus comes over the skyway, the vista, and I remembered it very detailed because I woke up afterwards and I thought, wow, that was a heavy duty dream. Well, fast forward 6 weeks later, I'm in Boston and I'm walking over to meet my parents at Faneuil Hall. And I see the exact same spot that I had previewed in my dream in Minneapolis 6 weeks earlier.
Wow.
And at that point, I leaned on the little footbridge there in the harbor. I leaned on that railing and I thought, I'm either losing my mind or it's being expanded in ways I've never imagined. So I told Greer about it, and he says, well, a lot of what you're going to find out in my lecture and in field work has to do with mind and consciousness. So I wrote this, what I thought was a really good 20-page, double-spaced feature story about him and Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence. My dad loved it. My dad was an old Air Force guy, and he thought, this guy might be onto something, but I could not get that piece published anywhere. I mean, there was very little media coverage on topic for, as you indicated earlier, 30 some years until, we got into this current century. So I told Greer, I said, look, I can probably get you more exposure by doing some pro bono public relations work for you than I can with just publishing one piece. And he says, okay, let's do it. So we went off. We had quite a few adventures together in the 90s, most of which are recollected in the book. And that's how I became a publicist in the what Dr. Greer used to call the UFO ghetto.
And, once again, the idea of being able to bring more attention to this, there has been a huge movement over the last couple years. And even now, with whistleblowers coming out, talking about psionics being involved with UFO, UAP phenomena, Martin, before we really dig into that and crack that nut and how that applies to things like the CE5 protocols. We'll get into the CE5 a little bit. But what kind of cases, what kind of things did you get a chance to witness while you worked there? You must have had some amazing opportunities to hear about some great cases, things like that, while you worked at CSETI, Martin.
Well, I was exposed to quite a bit of the information that ended up becoming part of the best available evidence package for Greer's first disclosure event in Washington in 97.
Wow.
He had another one at the press club in D.C. in 2001 that I was not involved in. And then at his invitation, I attended the third one he held in Washington. I think it was now 3 summers ago this June.
Yep.
I was exposed to a lot of documents. Some of them I thought, I don't know, not sure these pass the smell test, and I don't have the credentials to, weigh in whether they're hoaxes or
Sure.
fakes or they're the real thing. Also exposed to a lot of cases like the Cash Landrum event, the Stephenville
Yep.
sighting in Texas. That went over to the George W. Bush Ranch,
Yeah.
which I think spooked the hell out of his security teams.
Yeah. A little bit.
But the most notable occasions, and these are detailed pretty heavily in the book, were the disclosure event in '97 and the run-up to that, which also included Dr. Ed Mitchell, the sixth astronaut to walk on the moon. Ed was a great guy. I used to worship astronauts as a kid. I had autographed pictures of the guys up on my walls, along with pictures of Bob Dylan and the Beatles and the Stones. I mean, I put them all on kind of a high pedestal. The other thing was our trip to Mexico to the volcano zone. If you want to see UFO, UAP, whatever you call it, flying saucers, go to the volcano zone. It's about 80 miles from Mexico City. You can take a nice air-conditioned modern bus to a place called Puebla and then grab a cab and go to Metepec. And there's a wonderful little resort-type setting there where you can go out under the night sky at night. And you're going to see some interesting stuff coming out of Mount Popo, Mount Popocatépetl, Aztec word, meaning translating loosely as asleep, as the sleeping giant, I think. Anyway, we had the unfortunate case of crew from CBS's show 48 Hours shadowing us,
Oh,
and
wow.
they made us look like idiots. I mean, the way they cut this segment together, the lack of information. Mexico had experienced an ongoing UFO wave in the early 90s,
Yep.
started when there was a total solar eclipse and these objects were showing up on everybody's video cameras, not just out in the country where we were with Dr. Greer's group, but in Mexico City itself. I mean, tons of daylight and darkness photos
Yeah.
and video, lots of video. So that was probably one of the more exciting times with Dr. Greer when we were doing a contact event down there, and having a TV crew in your face is a little daunting,
Yeah.
but that's, I think chapter 8 totally gets into what that was about, and it also talks about the horrible job media had done covering this subject, and references another book that I encourage any of your viewers to watch, and that's Terry Hansen, the late Terry Hansen's book called The Missing Times. It's all about UFO coverage and the complicity of media in never reporting the story straight. It's a wonderful book. It's highly referenced. It's also a good kind of textbook study on how propaganda works, and it's very well researched. Terry was a great writer. And if you can find it, I urge you to get it. I quote it pretty heavily in my chapter 8 of the Space Pen Club book. I also met Terry once when he
Oh,
presented
cool.
at the Science Museum here in St. Paul, of all places. He had a 3-day symposium on the UFO issue back in the 70s, which pretty much unheard of back then, but pretty well attended. They had a lot of heavy hitters. Unfortunately, one of them that was invited, Dr. John Mack, did not make it, but a lot of other folks from academia and the scientific realm were there. It's really sad when Terry passed, but if you can find his book, man, it's as good as mine.
Well, and you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because I have worked in media. I have worked in sidestream media and alternative media as well. And once again, the fact that there has been such an on the heels turn to this and to this topic and to the way that it is treated, not only by local news, but print news, magazine media, everything. It's pretty fascinating to see the way that it has, because it happened literally with the release of the Black Money article by Blumenthal. So for
Blumenthal,
you,
and Leslie Kane.
And Leslie Kane, yeah.
And the Times military reporter, I'm blanking on her name, but when you get a front page story about UFOs on the cover of the Sunday Times, people are going to take notice, and people did take notice, especially other media organizations.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I can't say that I don't know what the end point is in all of it. You know, everyone keeps saying disclosure, disclosure, disclosure. Two things on that. Well, what happens after disclosure? Number two, I become very, I guess, agnostic about this topic, and sure, also, frankly, kind of bored with it. I haven't done a lot of shows like this in a couple of years, because I just figure, you know, this thing's either got its own momentum and it's going to come to some earth-shattering point, or it's going to get shut down like it has
every other time
over the last 100 years.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm watching from a distance now. I'm not placing any bets on disclosure, yes, pro or con, but I am following the big players like Greer and
absolutely
constitutional attorney Danny Sheehan, who
who
I highly respect. I loved all his work he's done on all the corruption in Iran-Contra and the Pentagon Papers, et cetera. Dan's full-on dedicated to this. So I'm watching these guys move around the board, the chessboard, and hoping for the best. But, you know, I'm not going to go out and wave the flag anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's something that we bring up on the show pretty regularly, Martin. Our show is not a sensationalistic show. We don't dig rabbit holes all over the place. We try to demystify topics. And when you're talking about, even whenever we've had Stephen Bassett on the show talking about big D disclosure, as we call it, the idea of government disclosure, what you're seeing in the halls of Congress and on the floor of Congress, you are never going to see them wheel out a gurney with a sheet in an aha moment, you know, where it's like, let's pull it off. There's the wreckage. It's not going to happen. What you're going to see is something along the lines of an Oliver North from an alphabet agency saying, yes, we have had programs. We have funded them. I've helped shift the money. You're going to see a fall guy of some kind eventually come out.
I mean, I don't think you can get more of a fall guy than you have in David Krush. I mean, his criteria and intel credentials are impeccable.
Exactly.
And he's, you know, he said to the Senate committee 2 summers ago, we have the bodies, we have the biologics, and we have the crash retrieved vehicles.
Yep.
And that's what the public needs to see in some fashion. Are they ever going to see it? I'm skeptical.
I don't think that they will, but I think that what we're also seeing and what he attested to there in his testimony was the fact that it was my job to follow the money. And when I finally found the door that the money led to, they slammed it in my face. So I think, if anything, once again, that's what we'll end up seeing is somebody from behind the door. You won't see the wreckage. You won't see, if anything, you'll see something like that be monetized for the means of war or be monetized for the means of the product shelf because of the vast amount of time and money that it took to reverse engineer it. However,
And we already have all
Yeah, absolutely. fiber optics, lasers, all kinds of things.
No, and according to Greer, we've had anti-gravity vehicles since the 50s.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And probably that's what a lot of people have seen over the years are some of our own stuff that has been reverse engineered.
Yep.
But I had another thought there, but it just left my radar.
Oh, I'm sorry. But the idea of disclosure, though, and the idea of this coming moment of humanity, there is that idea that is not unsound necessarily from the, I almost said the Warren Commission, but it's not the Warren Commission, the think tanks that decided that if we should ever find life in space, that we should keep that quiet. We shouldn't let the public know. It would unweave society as we know it. You know, anytime that a more advanced society comes along, the primitive one tends to cease to exist. So,
well, what it would unweave would be the petro economy. You know, the oil economy would collapse if this technology ever was widely dispersed universally. You know, I was fortunate enough to have Danny Aykroyd, famous Saturday Night Live writer, actor, musician, write a foreword for my book. And, you know, the things Aykroyd said, I'm going to read it verbatim.
Please.
Because I think this is right on the money, so to speak. He wrote, "The Space Pen Club is also an essential read for anyone interested in getting to the truth about one of the greatest mysteries and enigmas in our existence. Who owns these hyper-advanced off-world aerodynamic platforms? Who controls their obviously intelligent non-human operators? And if these things are known to anyone, why can't the technology be shared now? The mechanisms and fuel sources in these crafts could help save our planet and provide basic needs for millions: power, clean water, and climate temperance."
Yeah.
Dan, you nailed it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you know, he's not the only one singing from that choir book. It's the, you know, Dan Sheehan, the Steve Bassetts of the world, the Dr. Greers of the world. And some of the whistleblowers now that are, you know, have come forward through these, what are starting to look like sham government committees, the RO committee in particular, I think.
Yeah.
Is nothing but a stopgap. And the fact that Sean Kirkpatrick came and went as fast as he did, I think should have been the first indication that they weren't really serious about.
Yeah.
Going where they need to go in this.
Yep. And I've said it even before on this show, that I will say that the one good thing that came from Aero is at least now there is a unified means of reporting for people that wear wings or in the military, anything like that. You know, at least now it's not like, oh, if you work for United, maybe call these people. If you work for, you know, the U.S. Marines and fly a helicopter, maybe call these people. There's not a lot of maybes. Now there's like, hey, at least there's one place to go file a report, and you don't risk your entire career to do so.
So there's more, that's a plus. There's more transparent infrastructure in place to deal with that type of reporting and people to come out and become whistleblowers without being prosecuted or losing their pensions or, in some cases, maybe their lives.
Yeah.
But I think at the end of the day, the public is going to ask, and I'm asking this question now myself, what's in it for me? I mean, I've got to, you know, I pay my mortgage. I got, you know, I got daycare bills. I got, you know, grocery prices are still up. How would a disclosure impact my world? Well, if it's done right, and if the right players and the right strategies are in place, it's going to benefit all of us in ways that Danny Aykroyd and Dr. Stephen Greer and many others have been talking about, and that's using these advanced cosmic technologies, zero point gravity, energy, you know, quantum, thinking and computing. I mean, it's going to be very dramatic, but the gatekeepers are not going away.
Yeah. No, they definitely aren't. And I think, sadly, I think that's a misnomer that a lot of people have in mind right now, is the idea that the floodgates are wide open. It's like, no, things are still on a fully pressurized release, you know, and a nice slow trickle of what's coming out, you know, but a steady stream.
Yeah, there is a steady stream, but I say in the book, I think in the concluding chapter 10, that a real disclosure would be one that would be jointly done with the ETs or initiated by ETs. And frankly, I don't think they're too interested in doing it. I don't know if we've earned the right to have it. This is still a warring planet. You don't have to look very far into the news to see what a kind of wretched state we're in right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm in Minnesota where, you know, we're still in shock and mourning over a political assassination of a leading congressional leader here and her husband.
Yep.
Gunned down 2 weeks ago by somebody impersonating a cop, allegedly.
Yeah.
And you know, that's the kind of stuff that is dominating civil discourse. I think everybody's going, how have we gotten to this point? How do we get away from it? Personally, I think we're in a slow motion civil war that is ramping up every time there's a horrific incident like the one here in the Twin Cities two Saturdays ago. Yeah. So you can talk disclosure all you want, but when the social and political fabric of your country is unraveling in front of you, where are you going to put your attention and your efforts to change things?
Well, and you know, that kind of brings up a pretty good point about some of this technology, Martin, which is vibrationally and psionically based. You know, and just the idea of vibration, thought form, even whenever you talk about summoning craft, bringing craft about, especially with things like CE5 protocol, that kind of stuff. The idea of there being that new form of contact beyond a close encounter of the third or fourth kind, fourth being abduction, things like that. But the idea of human initiated contact, where do you stand on non-human intelligence in that kind of way, Martin?
Well, that was one of the things that I was most intrigued by, when I met Greer and began to look into his MO and his whole, the number of white papers he's written on consciousness and making contact, consciousness being kind of a interstellar leveler, you know, a level playing field, because these beings obviously have a advanced type of consciousness that might be also assisting in their ability to travel from point A to B without, you know, by bending the, you know, the time-space continuum. I get into a little bit of that in the book as well, but where do I stand on it? I, you know, when I first got into the CSETI realm, I thought this is the stupidest thing I've ever done, and it's the most fascinating. And you know, 30 to 40 years later, I still feel that way because it's such a new arena. But if you choose to look into what, you know, consciousness studies, how they're evolving and how people are embracing them more and more, I mean, that's a hopeful development.
I would tend to agree as well, especially the idea of a general shifting of consciousness toward a positive vibration to manifest these things. I guess the one thing that I've always wondered and warned about is that idea of something else acting in the guise of what is being manifested. You know, the cautionary tale of that and the idea of Ergogor and a mass manifestation of thought form and the things that could go awry in that way if you don't have a balanced outlook or, you know, any kind of, I guess, spiritual training in that kind of way. But
yeah, and I think that's I'm glad you brought that up, because I think what we're seeing now is some of the reactions we're getting out of old guard Pentagon brass is, you know, these entities are demonic in nature.
Yep.
And that's all they know. I mean, that's their cosmology. You know, I was raised a pretty strict Catholic back in the 60s, and it was good and evil, and there wasn't anything in between or beyond. But, you know, it turns out there's quite a bit beyond good and evil entities. And I think people can wrap their heads around that and be open-minded enough to do reading on topic from trusted sources. You know, it's a new day, and we need that. We need that new day.
Absolutely. And the new way of thinking, you know, one of the things that I bring up just as a audio video engineer to people is the problem with the black and white thinking, like good and evil in that kind of way, the hard line black and white is you're feel free to take a look at a black and white TV without a contrast knob. Where you can't tune the shades of gray. It's a very ugly picture. You can't see much. There's not a lot of definition. There's no depth to the image. It's a very, very distorted image of what is really there, you know, and that's just it. If you're missing the thousand shades of gray between those things, then you've really polarized the image in a totally different way, and you're processing the data through a polarized filter.
Very well may be demonic entities that are interfering with people's lives or being viewed like a Skinwalker Ranch or whatever, but there's lots of other entities. And I think the whole role of mind and consciousness, I want to read a little excerpt that I have in my book from Colonel John Alexander, who wrote this wonderful book.
Awesome guy.
Many years ago, called UFOs, Myths, Conspiracies, and Reality, Colonel Alexander says, "We agree that at times hard physical craft exist, but there is much more to the phenomena. Unfortunately, the true boundaries are unknown. It seems certain that human consciousness is at least part of the formula." So there's a lot of people smarter than you and I who have been studying this a long time, and the consciousness, the mind component of this discussion, I think, should be in the foreground rather than the background.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially, you know, especially when you're talking about that concept of frequency and vibration, which is a huge part of the physics of UFO UAP technology. One of the people that I talk about regularly on the show in regards to that is Hal Putoff, who's right here at UT, you know, learning to squeeze energy out of a vacuum is his newest project, and that is absolutely awesome and amazing. But even the idea of his seminal work and paper that led to remote viewing, you know, that idea of quantum entanglement, that we can affect something at a distance. The idea that a laser physicist wrote that, the idea that a laser physicist is read in on these things. Why a laser physicist? Well, you have to physically know how to change the frequency and vibration of a medium, be it a nuclear dye or a solid crystal like ruby, or what have you, a slice of semiconductor wafer so that it emits infrared radiation the way you want. But you've got to know how to vibrate a medium enough to change the way that photons pass through it. That's how you make a laser.
I think Hal Puthoff probably knows much more than he'll ever be able to share before he's off planet.
Yeah.
He's certainly one of the pioneers of remote viewing and now the whole energy from zero point is, it's becoming more prevalent and acceptable in scientific and traditional academic circles. So it'll be easier, it'll be easy to and interesting to watch what develops there. But again, for the public in general and everyone yelling for disclosure, we need to be thinking beyond that. And we need to figure out ways to save our democracy, number one.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's the bigger challenge right now.
Well, and that's something like my father is one of them, Martin, that is all, what are you talking about? Wasting Congress's time with little green men, things like that. And I'm like, well, here's the thing. If you owned a McDonald's and you found out for the last 70 something years, this one gentleman has been shuffling your money around and taking it to the order and tunes of billions and trillions of dollars, wouldn't you want to hold that guy accountable? Because we've kind of got an Iran-Contra of black budget going on with this stuff to the tune of billions and trillions of dollars. So wouldn't you like to know where your tax money is going? Wouldn't you like some kind of accountability? And I think if anything, that once again is really the key to cracking a lot of people's opinions about it and getting it off of technology and bringing it to the point of almost a Doge concept where it's like, no, there's billions of dollars being spent on this black budget. What's it all about?
You know? If you can crack that nut, that would go a long way, I think. In my book, I speculate if a true disclosure that was done jointly with ETs and people here on the ground, that would change people's opinions overnight. But now I'm not so sure of that. I think you have to wrap all this stuff up and present it in a very, non-toxic environment.
Yeah.
To lay it out piece by piece. You have to, promise that you're not going to prosecute all these people who have worked in black ops for 100 years.
Yeah.
It's going to be
for
like
all their extra constitutional actions.
Yeah, it's going to have to be something like the truth and reconciliation strategy in South Africa when apartheid fell.
Yeah.
It's going to have to be something like that so that government officials, military, intel folks, civilians that have all been read into these, deep black projects, you got to give them a free slate or we're never going to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, and it's it is the day and age of I can answer that in a skiff instead of I choose to plead the fifth and on the grounds that my answers may incriminate me,
The skiff thing has a time and a place, but people want to hear what's going down in those skiffs.
absolutely, and that's just it, Like we've said with Steve Bassett on the show, like we said with Dr. John Hall, when it comes to targeted individuals and Havana syndrome, things like that, the only way that these things get handled and get exposed is through legalities, through the work of people like David Sheehan, stuff like that, who's out there fighting for this in legal means right now to make sure that disclosure does come.
The only lawyer I know who carries in his breast pocket of his sport coat or suit jacket carries around a little pamphlet containing the United States Constitution.
Right.
God love him.
Darn tootin', man. Because it really is that will bring all of this to light. So hopefully we can get to a point of disclosure. We are getting at least closer to a point of acceptance for most people. I mean, even our guest in the next segment, that's a lot of what we talk about, is the idea of normalizing the paranormal, Martin. So just the idea that we can now have this talk and people will actually listen to it instead of going like, oh, wow, that's a bunch of kooks.
Well, I think I've said in my book, there's no normal without the paranormal.
That's right. Well, and it's what I literally say in the intro to my field observation and encounter log for paranormal investigators is, as soon as the first step in the scientific method. Oh, you can't see it there. Here, let's bring it up on screen. The first step of the scientific method is observation, encounter. You know, like you have to have an encounter. So as soon as you had a paranormal encounter, the science started. The question's whether or not you bought a ticket or are you sitting at the station eating a Twix. You know, I do not get subsidized by Twix. But that's a real question, you know, and you have to be willing as somebody to say like, yes, because I had an experience, I can now scientifically contribute to the data set as a citizen scientist. You know, even if whatever's in your picture, your video, your audio clip, even if it is proven to be a known quantitative, as most things, even at SETI and things like that have been found to be. Other than the WOW signal and a few other small examples, you know, most of them are traced down to fast radio bursts, all kinds of things like that. However, the more of those things that we get that are explained in red circles, the more defined the known quantitative gets and the more narrowed the definition of paranormal becomes, which means it's easier to spot the actual anomaly and investigate what we need to investigate. So,
and I think in that same line of thought, I think we need to help people define or redefine this whole nomenclature around the abduction experience, the experiencer, you know.
Yep.
I'm an experiencer, but one of the main threads in my book is what am I an experiencer of? Was it an ET events that happened in my house? You know, I woke up at one morning at 4 or 3 in the morning after attending a big conference in Fort Collins with all the big hitters out there for the, I forget the name of it. It had some very heavy duty people speaking at it, including astronaut Brian O'Leary, who studied at Princeton and was going to be one of the Marsnauts.
Oh, wow.
Astronauts. Until NASA canceled that project early on. Anyway, I came back from this conference, and at 4:03 in the next morning, I woke up and there were 5 little red orbs in my room. And I looked at the clock twice to make sure I was, in fact, awake. And, you know, now 2 of them at the foot of my bed are moving synchronistically in opposite directions. And then I blacked out, and when I finally got up 2 hours later, I had some residual sensations at my crown chakra. I felt like all the my energy had been sucked out of me, and I was like that for 2 days. I couldn't even describe it to my wife. I didn't know even how to begin. So was that an ET event? Was that a quote-unquote demonic event? Or was that a manufactured event to put me off the subject?
Yeah, a MyLab, so to speak.
Yeah.
And the cases of that are interesting. And once again,
the MK Ultra stuff has not gone away.
It absolutely has not. We cover that a lot on this show. That is one of the, aside from experiencer outreach, you know, helping experiencers get help, things like that, one of the things that we truly stand behind on this show. And as a cause of this show is targeted individuals and targeting technologies, people who for decades have complained of symptoms like Havana syndrome, stuff like that. And there is
it's just an outgrowth of all those mind control programs
that
go back to this probably to the 60s, if not the 50s.
And it is fascinating when you start digging into the technologies that are out there that can cause brain fog, fatigue, start causing soft tissue damage to the brain, all kinds of things without ever even being near them. It's frightening.
Wonderful white paper that I quote in my book, written by I'm going to forget his name now, but it talks about how the UFO subject is awfully conflated and mistaken for things that are being done in the mind control world. And yeah. This guy wrote, what was his name? Martin Douglas, maybe? I should look it up in my book. Anyway, just Google it sometime. Mind control and the UFO issue. He wrote a 56-page white paper on it that he turned into a book. And I think the Black Hats came after him, and he withdrew publication of the book and said he, you know, pretty much denied that his work was valuable. But I think people got to him, but I think he was right on to the truth and how you can create these situations with like you're having a UFO experience.
Yeah.
No, you're not. You're being fried with some low intensity microwave.
Yep. And you know, I do a lot of binaural beat music, things like that. Just as an audio engineer, there are frequencies that you can use that are just below the range of human hearing. 19 hertz is one of them. That is where the average human hears 20 to 20, 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, 20,000 hertz is the average range of human hearing. So it's like one beat below where you actively hear, but it's the frequency, quote, the paranormal frequency, the one that makes you feel as though something else is in the room watching you. And it's fascinating how many places in the world are kind of tuned to 19 hertz as a harmonic frequency, religious sites, things like that. It's also the frequency at which the water in your eye begins to vibrate and hallucinations begin. So
wow.
Yeah, when you're talking about, and that's something that we talk about on the show regularly, the idea that even an experiencer who has been aboard a craft or in proximity of a craft, that's no different than getting an old analog watch near a magnet. It's always going to carry a magnetic field from that point forward. The vibration of the magnetic field is enough to program the sensitive thin dials inside of the watch, the cogs. With that magnetic field, and people are the same way. And it's fascinating how many people who have had an abduction experience, who have been aboard craft, who have been in proximity of craft, who begin to experience other paranormal phenomena after, almost as though they are tuned to a frequency, as though there's a shift in their dial that occurs.
I think that's exactly right. And if you read those books that came out by Doug Stratton and in the last 3 to 4 years, you know, the Hitchhiker Effect, you know, the work being done at Skinwalker in Utah, you open kind of a Pandora's box, and I think you need to be aware of that that's a possibility once you step into this realm.
Yeah.
Whether willingly or not.
Yep.
You got to be careful. You got to set some boundaries, and you got to hopefully get smart about what's real and what's not.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, especially with the dimensional science that's literally going on, the idea that we now have a count of at least 11 dimensions that we know of that exist in science. You know, so the idea of those being in proximity, those kind of being a meniscus away, like suds in a tub, the fact that something using a vibrational technology, it may not be from an alien planet at all. It may be from an adjunct reality. It may be from, you know, a reality that's adjoining us in the future. You know, that's one of my favorite hypotheses over the last year or so is the work of Michael P. Masters, anthropologist, who says if you take the evolution of humanity and the way that we have skeletally evolved and projected out about 10,000 years, we kind of start to look like grays. You know, our head capacity increases, our ocular cavities increase, our jawline gets smaller. And isn't it interesting how many of the messages of people who have experienced them get messages of take care of your planet. It's the only one you have. Like, take care of it. What if it, stay away from nuclear weapons. Like, there are these common themes that, you know, maybe it's people from the future who are us trying to come back and save themselves. You know, so there's some interesting hypothesis out there right now with these new dimensional sciences.
It could be people from the future. It could be ETs. It could be some entities actually hijacking your consciousness.
That's right.
Playing a film inside your head while you sleep. You believe you've been beamed up into a spaceship. I mean, there's a million different possibilities in this realm. Well, probably not a million, but there's certainly lots of different ways to look at this and to study it. And I hope that the people that have the resources and the time to do it will continue on that path.
Absolutely.
I will watch from the distance.
Well, and you know, I wouldn't necessarily say watch from the distance. You've definitely been at least ankle deep in the water in your time, Martin. So, you've at least
been
got
through that river, though, Chris.
You've at least got some soggy socks, buddy.
I've got a book to talk about, and I guess since we're almost out of time,
yes, please.
People want to order it. I mean, the easiest way to do it is just go to Amazon and pull it down off there.
Fantastic, and
you can also join my small little Facebook Space Pen Club group. We have some interesting conversations there. I think there's about 200 people there currently. And then you can occasionally find me blogging at www.thespacepenclub.com. Although I have not written a blog in over a year because I've been putting my attention toward a Bob Dylan memoir that I finished. It will be published next spring.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and like I said earlier in the show, I've grown a little bored with the subject. I know too much about it, so I'm waiting for somebody else to come forward and put it all out there.
It's one of those, you know, but people ask how I'm able to fractally see things as they're released in the media. And it's because I worked in the media. Like, that's how I can decode what is actively going on and what the cover story is, things like that. You know, once you've been involved in it for long enough, much like you, Martin, it becomes a little jaded. The techniques become a little old, and it's like, oh, well, there's that one again. You know, pull the other one. Wag the Dog happens in so many different ways and is fully alive and well right now. So, Martin, thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate it. I greatly appreciate
thank you, Chris,
taking the time to put the Space Pen Club together and to really coalesce what it is to go through not just a lifetime of inspiration by this topic, but actually being, once again, ankle deep in the waters of disclosure and helping get the word out there. So thank you for everything that you ever did for that and for everything that you were doing for the community through writing the Space Pen Club. Greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks for your time and all the folks that tuned in tonight.
Absolutely. We will be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff, Martin. Take care. Have a great evening.
You too, sir.
Absolutely. While you are online, everybody, checking out the amazing work of Martin Keller at thespacepenclub.com and getting your copy of the Space Pen Club, stop on by Curious Realm. That is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of our episodes, as well as the Knowledge Vault, full of tons of declassified government materials talking about UFO, paranormal, all kinds of things. Also, don't forget to stop on by Curious Research. That is where you can find all kinds of presentations about the paranormal, things like that. When we come back, From this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by Dr. Megan Rose to discuss the world of making the paranormal normal and exactly what is a spirit marriage? What does a spirit marriage mean? And how does that occur in the modern world? We will be getting into that and so much more with Dr. Megan Rose right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying through that. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products, as I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. They are your source for amazing CBD products. I have been using them for about 6 years now, and the products made by Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science are absolutely amazing. They use every part of the plant. Seeds, buds, stems, roots, leaves, every part is used, combusted, reused through a spagyric process to provide an amazing full-spectrum product complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more while you are there online. Make sure to stop on by the website of our guest in this segment, Dr. Megan Rose. I love her mission, Normalizing the Paranormal. We will be talking about that as well as her book and the concept of spirit marriages, intimate relationships with otherworldly beings. Welcome to your first appearance, Dr. Megan Rose. How are you today?
I'm wonderful, Chris. Thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here today.
I have been very excited since Michelle booked this appearance. I have been so excited to have you on because this is something I talk to experiencers all the time. And it's a huge cause in my life for people to understand the paranormal experience and the idea that much like any intimate experience that is sometimes thrust upon you in life. These things can be traumatic and traumatic to the point that people do not talk about them. They do not share them with loved ones. They don't even sometimes share the experience with the people that they had an experience with. And it leads to broken relationships, trains of broken relationships in life, you know, all kinds of things. So the idea of normalizing the idea of talking about a paranormal experience, you know, no different than talking about an assault or a mugging, things like that. There's reason why people go to support groups for those things so that they can talk about them. What brought you to the world of researching this topic to begin with, Doctor?
Yeah, well, I think that it, you know, the frame in which I approach the paranormal through my research and my practice and my book is a little bit more through the lines of wanted paranormal experience. So
sure.
This is something that someone has sought out or has been beneficial and benevolent in their life. And the reason that I have approached it through that frame, one is, you know, as an academic, you have to delimit your research and you need to focus, you know, yourself fairly sure. narrowly to collect the data. But number two, it's because that my own life, my own upbringing was through, I was raised in the Pentecostal Christian tradition. And so the paranormal in many ways was just sort of the water that I swam in, although we didn't label it as such, right? Mm-hmm. We named it and labeled it as spirituality, ecstatic spirituality, Pentecostalism.
Sure.
But that frame of laying out of hands, speaking in tongues, channeling the Holy Spirit was just yep. sort of the water that I swam in growing up. And so that, you know, sort of predisposed me to being an experiencer and B, curious about the experience of really embodied and ecstatic spirituality. Mm. And so later in life, after I had sort of left the Pentecostal Christian tradition and made my way through seminary and began to practice more embodied spiritual practices like yoga, tai chi, etc., I found that those practices had a similar phenomenology or a similar output as some of the Pentecostal experiences, meaning that sure. they woke up strange flows inside of my body and also within my subtle bodies, my, you know, perceptive field to other than human contact. And through a series of, you know, dreams and, really extraordinary visitation type dreams began to have contact of my own that that really caused me to pause and then want to study in earnest what was going on.
Yeah. And how many times in your life had you experienced that kind of contact, Megan?
Oh, I don't even think I could give it a number. I mean, that was just, you know, growing up in a tradition that every Sunday, you know, and twice yeah. on Sunday, once on Wednesday, often yeah. on a Thursday or Friday night, right? You're in that stream of the wisdom stream of that, you know, in the Pentecostals, it's very, you know, focused on the Holy Spirit, right? Yeah. Which is this Wisdom Sophia type energy that you're, you know, seeking to fill you, seeking to have this intimacy with. And so, you know, that was just a lifetime of practice that then took on a different face and a different flavor, mm. right? When I stepped more into the Shakta Tantric
sure.
stream, but it still had a very, it's like, you know, my body knew that it was a well-worn groove, you know, in my body and my nervous system.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, like you said, your doctoral work focused on these experiences, specifically the benevolent and wanted kind, which is a rising topic, actually, especially in the world of UFO UAP study. It's been there for years. There's an Austin Seance Society here in town, things like that. So the idea of sought after connection with the paranormal has been out there for a while, especially in the study of parapsychological. But when you start talking about especially cryptozoology and even UFO UAP, there is, I don't know, at least for me, kind of that concept of Ouija board intent mm. when it comes to those things. Did your study go into any of that? Did any of your doctoral work focus on the type of intent used when contact was being attempted?
If you're talking about the mechanism, like using a Ouija board or divinatory tools, my research focused primarily on the phenomenological lived experience of having a bonded relationship with an other than human being.
Okay.
So, what I looked at was the folkloric, the mythological, the historical, the religious studies, from a survey, a transcultural survey of how has this happened traditionally? How long has it been going on? Where has it been happening? And the answer to all of that is it's been going on since recorded history, right? We have accounts of it in the Sumerian sacred marriage. It is transcultural, meaning I've yet to find a continent where these practices do not manifest. So it's all around the globe. It's a global phenomena. And it continues to this day. And so the core of my research was that last question, or that last statement, it continues to this day. And my question centered around, well, how do experiencers have an experience, and why? What's the purpose of it? How is it entered into? And what does that look like in different traditions? And because that my background is in seminary and religious studies, I really wanted to look at spiritual traditions that sure. have this as a core practice. And so I looked at the Vodou tradition coming out of both Haiti and New Orleans. I looked at the Shakta Tantric traditions in South Asia. I looked at the West African tradition coming out of Burkina Faso. I looked at contemporary American traditions like fairy seership and witchcraft, and a few other ceremonial magic also fell within that purview. Yeah. And really, the question was, how do people experience these bonded, loving relationships with other than human beings, and why?
Well,
are they entering into them?
Well, let's get into that real quick. Let's start exploring the why people get into a bonded relationship with the spirit. Because it's one of those, once again, being brought up Roman Catholic, being a Roman Catholic seminarian, right over my shoulder, I literally have The Rite of Exorcism. Pretty rare book to find. But there are a lot of things that it specifically warns against when it comes to that connection. Because, of course... If you aren't schooled, if you don't know the difference, there could very well be something with ill intent hiding in the guise of something that you're actively looking for, right?
Yeah, I mean, discernment is really paramount. And so discernment and support, meaning you're not doing this within a vacuum. And that was really the impetus behind writing my book and doing the research, is that when I was experiencing contact 20 some odd years ago, I really didn't have support. I really didn't have guidance, and I had to learn how to discern what I was experiencing, and go through sort of all the exercise of, you know, is this gestalt? Is this fantasy? Is this, you know, and sort of move through and educate myself about extraordinary spiritual and dream contact experience, and then find a community, find a mentor, find a grounding for that that could help me discern whether this was going to be a benefit to my life, or whether it was going to be something that I didn't want to step into, and in so much as that is. That discernment piece is, you know, stepping into our own sovereignty, our own power, our own agency, right?
Yes.
And saying, you know, I do have the ability to say yes or no. I do have the ability. And so then, you know, as part of that, I had to develop the toolkit. And my toolkit I drew from was ceremonial magic to learn how to banish unwanted spirits.
Sure.
So that's the first thing, you know. How do you banish the ones you don't want, and how do you contact or deepen a devotional relationship with the ones that you do want.
Well, and set up your protections beforehand as well, before you even begin that contact process. And that's one of those things that, like, they're CE5 is burgeoning large, Megan, and we're talking big groups of people getting together with intent, trying to summon something forth. You know, and it's one of those, like, I'm wary. I'd love to go to one. I'm fully in for the experience. I've gone to numerous paranormal, investigations, things like that in my life. But it's one of those, even though I've brought mediums with me, it's never been one of those, let's walk around and have the medium poke and ask questions. Mm-hmm. You know, just to make sure.
Yeah, I think we need to be, you know, there's a couple of things, Chris. I think sure. we can draw from, and this is why I did a transcultural survey, because we can draw from other spiritual traditions outside of the West that and learn from how they do this, right? Because the summoning, the discernment, the control, if you will, of spirits, it is a very well developed and practiced technology in many other cultures that take spirit and paranormal contact seriously. It is less well developed here in the West because that our highly scientistic culture invalidates these experiences at the outset as fantasy, make-believe, or, you know, worst-case scenario, pathologizes them. And so until we normalize, until we understand that on a spectrum of human consciousness, the paranormal is one flavor or one shade of our consciousness as humans, and that is a normal part of human beingness, we are always going to be struggling to figure out how to understand and frame these experiences, and a little bit behind the eight ball when it comes to how to navigate the contact that is absolutely happening.
Yeah.
But as you said, you know, so many of our religious institutions have demonized these practices and thrown the baby out with the bathwater. And, you know, in many ways, that was a very deliberate decision by a lot of the monotheistic religions, because that having your practitioners, having your congregation speaking directly to spirits and spirits that weren't necessarily sanctioned by your church is dangerous, right? And dangerous in so much as, God forbid, we might actually have revelation. We might actually have an experience that bumps up against the hegemony, right, of the church or the religion. And so to step into a sense of personal sovereignty with spirit communication is very heretical. But, you know, the idea of heresy and the core of the word heretic is one who's able to choose.
Yep.
And so we're stepping into choice here. We're stepping into who are we and what are we connecting to, and really having to disentangle some of the prejudice that has been overlaid on connecting to beings that were not necessarily sanctioned, saints, angels, deities that were not sanctioned by the church, as it were.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And especially that concept of consent and agency is something that we try to drive home on this show all the time. I mean, even whenever it comes to living your everyday life and anger and things like that, like the idea of consenting into that system, like, no, you have consented to give that other person your energy by being angry. Mm-hmm. Like, that's why you're so tired. afterward. You've literally consented to give that energy away. You could have used it to build all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And even the idea of going into Kabbalah and the teachings of Kabbalah and the idea of because we were breathed life into by the Creator, that we take part in that creative spirit, that what we say matters, which is where the whole idea of casting spells, things like a Solomnic magic, the seals of Solomon, things like that, where, yes, you are controlling angels, demons, jinn, things like that, and calling them forth for a relationship with them in that kind of way. And even this is strange, audience, but even whenever you think of that relationship between yourself and divine creator, you do have to have that lover concept. When you have that, and it even speaks of that in the Bible, the idea of treating Christ like a lover, you know, mm-hmm. and being there and letting that envelop you. And there with that is even the concept of consent, of surrender, the idea of you are no longer fighting that river. You're a part of the river, which empowers you to be part of it. So even universally, that concept carries over even into the mm-hmm. paranormal.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you brought up something that really was a key pivotal research piece, and that is looking at the monastic traditions in Christianity, mm. right? The Brides of Christ.
Absolutely.
The marrying of the nuns who, you know, wear wedding rings and talk about Jesus is my husband.
Yes.
This is a contemporary practice.
Absolutely.
Because that it is Jesus, right, and Christianity is a mainstream, largely embraced religious tradition, it's a sanctioned spirit marriage. But it is not, by any stretch of the imagination, the only way or form that people step into these bonded, loving relationships. And, you know, just a side note on intimacy. And this came up again and again in my research. You know, intimacy looks like a lot of different things. You know, a lot of people hear marriage and they think, and they hear intimacy and they think, oh, you're talking about sex or eroticism. And like, that might be a part of the relationship. It certainly was with the case of St. Teresa of Avila,
sure.
John of the Cross, as well as the Beguine monastics. You know, if we're just looking at the through the Christian
Absolutely.
Lens.
Absolutely.
But it is not, you know, marriage looks like so many different things.
Yes.
Just if we just look at the human corollary of marriage, it's many, many different things. And some marriages are not necessarily erotic. But the intimacy is something that is a kind of co-creative relationship between
yes.
An I and thou relationship, to borrow the line from Martin Buber, right?
Yeah.
And so we are stepping into, and I used the term marriage specifically because I wanted folks to really understand that we're talking about a commitment that
yes.
you step into with an other than human being. And that commitment might be for a lifetime. It might be for a season, just like human marriages might be for a lifetime. It might be for a season. But it is this deeply committed relationship that you step in. And often in a spirit or an other than human kind of marriage, it is for some sort of co-creative project. There's and this is, again, through the frame of the benevolent or the wanted spirit marriage. It is, and that's why marriage as well. Marriage is usually, not always, but usually something we want and we step into and we say yes to. And so it's about, yes, I want this bond and for X, Y, and Z purpose.
Well, and I was just about to say for specific things as well. You know, marriage is a contract. It's a social contract that you've made with somebody because we are both achieving this out of it. You know, we are both. I mean, the one thing me and my wife say all the time is we've got that handled. That's the one thing that we don't have to worry about in life anymore. That's done. And much say what you want about a celibate priesthood, but when you aren't chasing tail all the time, you'd be surprised what you get accomplished in life.
Sublimation of the erotic energy, you know, but it's interesting in so much as, you know, I also teach courses on sexuality, culture, and religion. And what I really like to do at the very, very onset of that course, because I teach at Cherry Hill Seminary, and which is a seminary for pagan and animist ministers. And one of the things that I like to do is reframe what we even are talking about when we're talking about sex and sexuality and eroticism.
Yeah.
Right? Because that so many, and again, this is our Western frame. So many folks think of sex and they think, or sexuality and eroticism, and they think, oh, genital stimulation, arousal. And yet, if you look transculturally around the world, intimacy, eroticism, sensuality is a full body experience. It has the potential to be a full body experience that really is more about connecting to our vitalism. Wilhelm Reich called it our orgone energy, but in the Taoist tradition, it's your jing qi, your prana, your vitality, your aliveness, which makes you puts you into rapturous moments. And that rapturous moment could be the rapturous moment of an orgasm, but it could just as easily be a rapturous moment out in nature or hearing a gorgeous piece of music or looking at a piece of art. And so that really, I like to reframe sexuality as our aliveness, our vitalism.
And that's just it, because it's one of those kind of like they tell you a marriage prep. You know, like, what are you going to do when you're 75 and you can't do that anymore? You know, like, is that now just the end of your marriage? You know, and it's the example that I give regularly is the concept of the muse. There was once the idea of the muse, and even the idea of the hearth and the muse of the home, where you made a space in your home for the mine is right here. Like, you're looking at my space for the muse. This is it. And people ask me why I have it. And it's because it is a place of purposeful intent to invite the muse. And when the muse comes, I'm not wasting 3/4 of the muse's energy setting things up and getting aggravated with cables not working and things like that. I am able to court my muse. And when she appears, we make lovely music together, and then I let her go, and she'll come back. But me and my muse have literally been together for 20-something years, and that is my spiritual love affair. Like, no doubt, she has never, ever, ever left me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's beautiful, Chris, and that's such a great example, you know, of, you know, Plato would call that your daimon.
Yeah.
Right. The daimonic intelligence that we're all born with.
Yeah. Because I don't write. I channel 3/4 of my music. I do not take pen to paper. It comes through me. And when something strikes me, I hit record and then I do that again.
And so, you know, my research is very in some ways adjacent, but also informed by that type of muse or tutelary deity or channeled spirit type of connection that we might have. And what I would say with spirit marriage, what makes it slightly different, but maybe quantifiably no different, is that in the spirit marriage, one has gone through some sort of a ritual or formalized engagement and then marriage period where you and that is specifically because that there are agreements that are being made. And so often with a tutelary deity or a muse type relationship, they're with you, they're teaching you. It's almost like a mentorship and or a friend, a deeply loving friendship. And with the marriage, usually the spirit, but sometimes the human, will propose a deeper level of commitment to that relationship. And some folks have reached out to me and said, you know, I had this teaching spirit, this tutelary spirit, or this spirit guide, or this this muse type spirit for years and years, and I've realized that it is more than that, and I want it to be more than that, or they want it to be more than that. And then, you know, that sort of, you go into this sort of betrothal like you would in any, you know, hopefully in any human marriage.
Into an actual courtship.
Yeah, and you're negotiating. You're like, okay, well, what is that going to mean?
Yeah, if I don't like seafood.
Right.
You know, things like
that. You know, the great example that I love that I can pull out of my research is that I interviewed some Haitian Vodou practitioners. And they were a lineage of practitioners, grandmother, mother, and daughter, who were all mambos or priestesses mm-hmm. in the Haitian tradition. And the grandmother was a fairly prominent mambo. And when her daughter was born, the daughter did not want to be a mambo. She wanted to do, you know, regular life stuff, and went into, I believe it was the nursing field. But the spirits, you know, the spirits that were strong and part of that family had other ideas. And so it took her a number of years to finally accept that she was loved by the spirits, and that was going to be part of it. She was still a healthcare practitioner, but that was also part of her path. And but one of the spirits that wanted to marry her was the spirit Dambala. Who is, if you're familiar with that pantheon, that Loa is associated with snakes. And this woman was deathly afraid of snakes. And she's like, okay, Dambala, if you want me to marry you, here's the deal. You can never appear to me as a snake. You can take on whatever guise that, you know, you want to present to me as, but it just can't be a snake, because I don't truck with snakes.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the arrangements that they made. And then her daughter, the granddaughter, when she was born, the spirits showed up at the birth and claimed her and said, this is, and so by the time she was, I think 13, 14, she had entered into her first spirit marriage with the spirits. In that tradition, it's called the mariage loa, and it's, you know, you're committing to this relationship with the spirits. And she was married to a variety of spirits because in that tradition they're very polytheistic, and so you can have more than one marriage to one of the loa of the spirits. But she's married to a human man who is also an ungan, or a priest in that tradition. He's married to spirits. And in that frame, in that tradition of Vodou, you usually set aside a night every week, or one night a week, to be with just your spirit spouse, and you don't sleep with your human partner. But she said, you know, if we followed that protocol, my husband and I would never sleep in the same bed together.
Yeah.
So she's like, we had to negotiate. We had to find something that was going to work for all of our spirit spouses and for us each up together. And I love that story because it's such a great example of like our agency and our ability to negotiate. It's not that these spirits come along and we say, oh, holy ones, just here's my life, take over. Yeah. Run it for me. It's like we need to step into co-creative dynamism with them, where we can set our boundaries, where we can make requests, where we can push back. And if that isn't happening, I think that's a really good indicator that it's not necessarily a spirit marriage that you're wanting to cultivate, or B, you really want to beef up your discernment practices so you have the internal velocity to stand in your sovereignty as a co-creator being with these spirits. Because as one of my mentors and teachers, Orion Foxwood, likes to say, we do things that they can't do. They do things we can't do. But together, we each bring something to the table.
That's right. Because we're flesh and blood, there are things that we can do that they'll never be able to do, you know. And that is hugely important because, yes, that gives us our agency. Not just the co-creation aspect gives us our agency. And once again, that idea of if we're all created by the same creator, then yeah, you know, we've all been breathed life into in that kind of way. So mm-hmm. we all take part in that equally. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there are listeners out there right now. I mean, I'm pretty involved in the remote viewing community. I love that community. I love remote viewing. I've had quite a spate of people whenever I post things about remote viewing online lately. Coming at it from the point of view that it is the work of the devil, doctor. And it's fascinating to me because their arguments are very much like, one person gave me the argument of John of Patmos, and went into, you know, Revelations. And I was like, I find it hilarious that you are trying to use somebody's vision right now to explain away visions and to tell me how having visions is a sin. There are, of course, people out there right now who are listening, who are decrying the fact that this is what leads to demonic possession, Megan. How can we allay those fears for people?
I mean, that's a whole other, that's a huge
it's a big topic.
It's a big tater, yeah. What I would say, and this is what because I teach courses on the Thonic or the dark deities, sure. Specifically through the frame of darkness, not as something that is evil or malicious, but as a necessary corrective to night or to light, right? We need the night just like we need the day. Yeah. We need the winter just like we need the summer. And it is this balancing that we're doing. And so the dark, what is often in a Western Christian influenced frame,
yeah,
anything that is dark or underworld is evil. And that is very much a byproduct of us living in a Christianized culture. That that has taught us, whether we identify as Christian or not, but has taught us to fear anything that is deep or thonic or erotic. Right? We are afraid of our anger. We're afraid of the top sort of top four. Yeah. We're afraid of the mystery. The not knowingness, what I call the primordial. We're afraid of the erotic or the wild. We're afraid of our fierceness, right? Our the velocity of fierce energy, and we're afraid of death. And those tend to be the deities or the spirits that people often label as demonic. Now, are there spirits or entities out there that don't look favorably on humankind? Yes, but in my estimation, a large majority of what gets labeled as evil is actually our own unhealed psyche.
Yes,
our own unexamined or even epigenetic trauma that we've inherited.
Yep.
That gets projected onto spirit, which is, you know, like, I think of like the thonic sort of elemental beings that are just sort of going along doing their thing. Yep. That they do. They're unbinding energies. They're energies of, you know, transformation. Yep. And decay, because like, think about how important compost and decay is in the cyclic arc of life and death and rebirth.
Yeah.
And then we start projecting. So here in the West, we're horrible about projecting all of our fears onto the boogeyman, which we label as Satan or demon or whatever. Yeah. And the course that I teach goes into deconstructing and really understanding that through a historical religious studies framework. What are you even talking about when you use labels like Satan or devil or Lucifer or whatever?
Absolutely.
But suffice it to say, I think that what is really needed here in the West is something that is done regularly and very beautifully in South Asia. And that is the taking out of our deities, of our spirit beings, and cleaning them off. So the murtis, the statues in the temples in India, which is also a pantheistic religion where they have all sorts of deities that are both fierce and benevolent. And the fierce ones are not evil. They are protector beings, or they have a certain roles that they form. And every you know, year at least, they're taken out of the temples and they're cleaned off. And I think that cleaning off, you know, literally they're cleaned off of all of the ghee and the offerings and the things, the incense that's been placed on them. But also that cleaning off is cleaning off all the projections, the detritus, the ideation that builds up, right, in the morphic field around those deities. And I think we need to do start doing that here in the West.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's one of those, I talk a lot and work and I make binaural beat music. I'm making binaural beat music to help experiencers now, all kinds of things. And one of the things I talk about regularly whenever I talk about our brains and the way that they work is, don't forget, a frequency is not just what you hear or the color of something. It's also your frequency of thought. So when you're frequently, and when it's a part of your schedule to clean your crystal friends, who are there absorbing your good energy, your bad energy, everything around you, you want to take care of them too. They get overburdened, you know, much like any car fuel filter. Like, feel free not to change your fuel filter or your oil filter. See how that works out for you, you know?
Yeah.
You have to.
Well, and
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we label things as good and bad, right? Or good and evil. And like high frequency energy, if that's all you're experiencing, it's like being experienced to 24/7 light.
Yeah.
It's maddening. You know, lower frequency energy we need. That's what we have that slows us down, that helps us downregulate a little bit when we're too sped up. Like, we need the facility, right? The facileness to move through the full spectrum of emotion, of vibration, of all of these things, and not get stuck, right? Not just get stuck in one somatic or one story. And when we demonize, right, entities that we don't really understand because that we've been programmed or we've inherited all of this, you know, this story, this frame around the lens that we're looking at these beings through, we limit ourselves. We bind ourselves into into more narrow bandwidths of understanding and experience. I'm a big fan of Dr. Jack Hunter and his paraanthropology, because Dr. Hunter did his PhD research in the spiritualist mediumship community in the UK. He's a UK researcher, and he's an anthropologist, and his whole modus operandi is similar to mine in that he doesn't call it normalizing the paranormal, but he does talk about paranormal as something that is a channel or a way in which humans have capacity and that has been, that can be looked transculturally again from an anthropological perspective to appear around the world. And you know, one of the things that I would say also about experiencing the paranormal is this: we all have the capacity to have extraordinary or extrasensory experience. The human nervous system and body, by and large, is wired that way. And will we all be extraordinary experiencers that have, you know, full tilt mystical experiences? I think that it can be trained, but some of us have more ability in that area. And I don't see it really as any different than any other skill that you're that you're good at that can be learned. You know, we can learn to play the cello. You can learn the notes. You can use the fingerings. You can get fairly good at it. Are we all going to be Yo-Yo Ma?
No.
No. it's a skill that can be evolved and worked with.
Yeah, and there are people who are naturally more adept at it. Like I got an 8-year-old, and he has an 8-year-old friend who right now is being looked at by like high school recruiters for baseball. He's that good at 8, you know, and it's one of those like D could go all day and play on his team. I love you, kid, but that's somebody who's just naturally good at something, you know, and much like manifestation, anything like that, even ecstatic prayer. You know, it's fascinating to me as somebody who used to be able to fall into a state of ecstatic prayer fairly easily, things like that, how remote viewing is quite literally the 180-degree flip coin of that. Like the process of getting into state for the two of them are totally different. One of them is like silencing the monkey mind and focusing on one thing. The other is like giving the monkey a typewriter, you know, and just letting it flow and letting it go. And to see that didactic of concept and to see that didactic even of connection within my life is fascinating just for me as an experiencer, you know. So how do we get people, I guess, how do we get the muggles to understand this? Doctor, number one, quit calling them muggles.
those who have not the first yet. Step. I mean, and that's it's a fair point, right? How do it? And I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, right? Because that it goes back to our educational system. Yeah. It goes back to our religious traditions and the way in which the paranormal is framed and held within religious studies. Yeah. You know, I think that the areas of paganism and shamanism and witchcraft are more, you know, in the past 20 years or so have been more embraced by groups like the AAR, American Academy of Religion. Yeah. But it's still, it's very... You know, there's almost this, well, if you're part of an indigenous spiritual tradition, like the Native American tradition or the African, you know, traditional religion traditions, then that's a legitimate paranormal. But if you're part of, like, you know, some of the Western witchcraft traditions, then there's a little more suspicion. It's getting a little bit better. But that's part of... and certainly Dr. Hunter's research in bringing this in, and you know, his mentor, I'm blanking on his mentor's name now. She was also at the forefront of bringing the paranormal into anthropology. In any event, it's becoming, there's conversations around this, but even, you know, in the study of like magic and the paranormal, it's still the academic study of these things, which often is a textually based, let's look at what happened in the past.
Sure.
And that's really where my work as a psychologist, comes in, because that I am less interested in the past and more interested in the present and the current experience and the current phenomenology of this.
Yeah.
And I think that part of it is just researchers, academics being willing to come out of the closet, if you will, out of the paranormal closet and talk about it. And I do. I have academics that have reached out to me and said, wow, like, thank you for being so gutsy in writing and talking about this very publicly.
You know, doctor, it's interesting. I get a lot of guff from a lot of communities because, like, I'm a fan of UAP. I'm a fan of UAP because I have scientific references like this in my collection. Note, phenomena. Like, that's part of science. You've got to be able to eliminate the phenomena from your data set. Mm-hmm. So that like if I was in chemistry class and I had a 4% of my solution that was not there in my equation, did it off gas? Did it turn to sediment? What happened to it? We need to find out what happened to that 4% anomaly there. Mm-hmm. So, the idea that now we have quantum physics proving the fact that spooky action at a distance and quantum entanglement exists. And when you start looking at, hey, we were all taught in ninth grade science that we're 90% empty space, that our electron shells extend for miles. You know, like you and I right now, by all physics that we know, are sharing an electron shell, doctor. You know, so the idea that we can communicate telepathically, the idea that you can remote view something via distance, the idea that you could even remote influence something. Fully within the realm of possibility with quantum entanglement. So, these things are letting scientists, I mean, that's literally the mission statement of Curious Research, is the fact that these things are rapidly coming together. So we as researchers of the paranormal need to get our data ready to meet science.
And I think that, you know, like Dr. Dean Radin.
He's
done some great research along those lines.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think that Dr. Radin's research, Dr. Hunter's research, as well as Dr. Jeffrey Kripal, who brings in more of the religious studies, but of, you know, these are all from various different disciplines looking at, and, you know, my work from the psychological, you know, so we've got Radin who's looking at the paranormal, Hunter who's looking at the anthropological, I'm looking at the psychological, Kripal's looking at, you know, the religious, and all of those different conversations, right, are part of this emergent conversation, which is seeking to, here in the West, reclaim what Dr. Hunter calls high strangeness as a part of our as a part of our normalized human experience.
Absolutely. And it, I know I've got you for about another 10 minutes. One of the prime examples that I give on the show all the time is Thiago Tietchi. He is the sole investigator for MUFON in Brazil. One investigator for all of Brazil. When I had him on the show at MUFON Symposium, I asked him, when I know it's not frequent that tribes come into town to give you a report, because it's like a two-day journey upriver into town. You know, they got things to do like live. But whenever you're out there, taking reports from people that work in the fields, work in forestry, work in oil fields, things like that. Do the locals and the natives give you reports? He's like, oh, well, they tell me about things, but they don't report them because for them, they're not strange. They've seen these things in their forest and in the sky for generations. It's part of their history. Like, it's an accepted normality for them. Yeah. It's us that it's strange to, not them.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that one of the things that actually bodes really well for, at least for the academies, is the rise of decolonization and post-colonization theory and that lens, which says most of our academy is rooted in this very colonialist mindset that says if you can't measure it, if you can't break it down to its bits and bytes, it's not real. That real versus unreal conversation is it's a moot point, as you said, in many indigenous cultures where the real isn't defined by science, it's defined by
experience,
by an intrinsic, animistic, in many ways, relationality, right? That does not put humans as the apex of intelligence on the planet, but humanity is a beloved, right? Humanity is in co-creative partnership with the planet, with Gaia, with other than humans' intelligences, which may be paranormal, but may also be corollary, like embodied, like animal intelligence, cetacean intelligence, forestry intelligence, ocean intelligence. In fact, one of my interviewees, Madrone, hails from the West African Burkina Faso tradition. And in her tradition, she is married to a tree spirit. So there is a physical being, this giant redwood tree that she's in relationality with, and that tree represents a consciousness or an entity within that cosmology of the Dogara people that has certain forms and functions. And she married and was asked to marry that spirit, which she had to go through a ritual, and the tree became a proxy for that spirit to perform certain functions for her community.
Yeah.
And that is a very different frame, right? Than our Western frame by
well,
and large.
And especially sociologically, psychologically, it's one of those, yes, there is nature versus nurture, things like that, but we are the sum of that and our experience, you know, and even whenever you start looking at things, whether it's psychologically or in a lab, scientific method begins with observation and experience. Like, that's where it starts. And I say that all the time. Like, if you've had a paranormal experience, the science train has left. The minute you had that experience, the only question is if you bought a ticket. You know, did you then start investigating your experience in a scientific way?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And I, you know, and I don't want to poo-poo science.
No,
right?
No.
Science
absolutely
is great.
Not.
Like, science is.
I mean, you're a doctor of psychology.
Right. And it gives us wonderful things like, you know, medicine and technology, Wi-Fi,
yeah.
So that we can do this interview while you're in Austin and I'm in San Francisco. But the measure of the human spirit, right? Like,
yeah.
How do you measure love? How do you measure devotion? How do you, you know, there are things that are numinous qualities, right?
Yeah.
That even relationship, I mean, you can get into like bonding hormones and mirror neurons and all that sort of stuff. But
yeah.
Ultimately, there are things about the human experience that are beyond or para scientific and will probably may very well always be. How do you measure the soul or this concept
yeah.
of the soul?
There, and, you know, it's one of those things that no different than you love who you love. You know, the minute that bell rings for you, it's because of what's there. It's not because of necessarily a choice you've made. And it's fascinating to explore that and to think about that as even a paranormal experience in that kind of way, in being
yeah.
connected to that vibration that somebody else is putting off and that you're both cooperatively putting out into the universe all at the same moment. You know, that's
yeah.
a very special tie-in connection. And when you can learn to resonate
yeah.
with that, beautiful things happen in your life. And, you know, it really is that beautiful idea of consent to connection, especially that romantic consent to connection to spirit, not only your own, but the spirit of the world and the universe around you and other spirits in the universe. Doctor, this book is awesome. I love this concept. I know you have a class to teach this evening. I would love to have you on again and again and again to talk about it. Like I said, I think this is one of the most important things for every paranormal community to understand, because it helps us understand the experiencer themselves in a different way, and the way that experiencer spiritually changes because of their experience, and how we resonate in a different way after. So before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to get their copy of Spirit Marriage, where they can go to sign up for your classes, where they can go to follow everything that is Dr. Megan Rose.
Yeah, it's all on drmeganrose.com, which you've got right there under my name on the screen. And the book is available at all online resellers and maybe some, you know, funky little occult bookshops in your area. I do offer a course, Spirit Marriage 101, which is a self-paced course that will take you through. In addition to the material in the book, the course really takes you through exercises. There's a workbook to help develop your own spirit marriage. And I am a practitioner of the fairy faith. So I do, as you're showing right there, I do offer a course on the fairy faith as a
amazing.
As an animistic tradition. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Fantastic. Well, I definitely want to have you on to talk about that.
Oh, wonderful. I would love to come back.
The people of the fae is one of my... touchstone topics that I bring up
yeah.
regularly, and its relation to just about all things paranormal.
Yeah, and very different than what popular culture would have us think that they are.
Yes, absolutely. Far, far from Tinkerbell. So thank you so much for your time once again, Doctor. Please do hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience for this segment. While you are online checking out everything from Dr. Megan Rose at drmeganrose.com, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can find all the episodes. That is where you can like, follow, subscribe, comment. That is where you can find our store full of all the books from our guests, as well as their courses, as well as your link to Curious Research. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, UFO, UAP, stop on by and get your field observation log. It is your back pocket scientific data log to put in all of your observational data from while you were on the field on investigations, so that come the day that you need to shake hands with science with your data, you are ready to do so. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what it takes to make the conversation, and without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.